Exodus chapter 15, verse 22 to chapter 16, verse 36. The 18th talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on October 9, 2016 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2016. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Handout number 16, Exodus 15:22 to 16:36, accompanies this talk.
We'll be looking at Exodus, jumping into chapter 15. As you'll recall, last week, the Israelites, they had left Egypt. First they went south, and then they went north, and they got pinned against the lake. And Pharaoh and his army came after them to round them up and take them back because he regretted letting them go. Saw that they were wandering around, thought that they were going to be easy pickings. So he went after them with his army, and the Israelites were very distressed because here they are stuck. There's no place for them to go. There's the water behind them, and the Egyptians are coming. But God spoke to Moses and said, "Stretch out your staff." And Moses did so, and the waters parted, and the Israelites went through on dry ground. Pharaoh and his army followed after. They went in on the dry ground between the walls of water. And when the Israelites were safely on the other side, Moses again raised his staff, and the water came crashing in and drowned Pharaoh's army, and it was completely destroyed. Afterwards, then, the Israelites had a great big celebration on the other side of the Red Sea and had a song that they celebrated with, and we have record of that song in chapter 15. Now we're going to pick up the narrative after the celebration. Now they're going to head out and start through the wilderness. Before we enter back into the narrative, last week Roger asked me, there are two times in chapter 15 in the song where it refers to what God had done for Israel as redeeming them from Egypt. And Roger's question was, if I got it correctly, he was asking, what was the price that was paid for that redemption? On what basis were they redeemed? And I said, let me look into that. So I spent some time doing so and found something that I did not know. I consulted Colin Brown. Colin Brown put together a lexical work of the Greek, but he gets into Hebrew words as well. And I wrote in the notes, if you have the notes, there are two quotes that I pulled out of Colin Brown that I thought were helpful. What he says in general is that the notion of redemption at that time, the Hebrew words that are used, don't have any connotation of a payment. I'll read the first quote. "Whenever men by their own fault or through some superior power have come under the control of someone else and have lost their freedom to implement their will and decisions, and when their own resources are inadequate to deal with that other power, they can regain their freedom only by the intervention of a third party." So that intervention by a third party is called redemption, whatever kind of intervention that is. There's another quote from Colin Brown. "It seems probable that the words ga'al and pada, which had a close association with the idea of releasing slaves and of reclaiming persons and things, were taken up into the vocabulary of Israel's writers as the most suitable terms to describe the liberation from slavery of those whom Egypt and Babylon had conquered, and the reclaiming of Yahweh into his faithful ownership of the people of his possession." So both of these words are used to describe what God did to free his people from Egypt, as well as freeing his people from Babylon when they returned from the exile. These words are used. Interestingly, Colin Brown points out that the association of redemption with a price appears to have been a development of the intertestamental period. That's when you begin to have the association of redemption with redemption for some price paid. But he says it is stretching the evidence to find this connotation in the Old Testament period. Okay. So if Colin Brown is right, then there's no price. We need not look for a price that was paid. God came and he rescued them out of slavery. That is redemption. First section, starting with verse 22 in chapter 15 of Exodus. Then Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, and they went out into the wilderness of Shur. And they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. And when they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore it was named Marah. So the people grumbled at Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" Then he cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree, and he threw it into the waters, and the waters became sweet. There he made for them a statute and regulation, and there he tested them. And he said, "If you will give earnest heed to the voice of the Lord your God, and do what is right in his sight, and give ear to his commandments, and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you which I have put on the Egyptians, for I, the Lord, am your healer." It's not known where the desert of Shur is. All we know is it's the first desert in the Sinai after you leave Egypt. But exactly where it is not known to us. It says here that I have then Moses led Israel, but literally it's caused them to go. And some commentators speculate as to whether there was reluctance on the part of the Israelites to actually move out. That may or may not be the case, but that could be a suggestion that there was reluctance to go. They are heading out now into the desert. They're heading out into an area that they know to be inhospitable to people. They travel for 3 days. Presumably, people who travel by foot through the Sinai, historically, especially when it's large groups that include children, they estimate that they will go about 15 miles per day. The caravans go 18, sometimes even 20 miles a day. But groups of people, including children, are more likely to go 15 miles per day. They go from waterhole to waterhole. If they don't know the route, then they find out from other travelers where they can expect to find the next place to replenish their water supplies. In between water holes, and that can be days, they carry enough water to get them to the next place. And they carry that water in animal skins. They don't use ceramic jars, they use animal skins, which makes it harder for archaeologists to trace them. In this case, in all likelihood, they've been going for 3 days without any additional water. They're just going with the water that they carried from the Bala Lake. I was thinking about this. If Moses, when he left Egypt, if he went directly to the Sinai, he probably would have gone this route to the Sinai area. If he went to Midian proper, he probably would have gone a different route when he went there. But on his way back, this is probably the route that he would have taken if he's coming from Sinai. Aaron, remember, went out to meet him. And if Moses was in Sinai, then Aaron may have gone this route and may have come back by this route. So Moses and Aaron may both have some knowledge about this route. The route that they are taking is, and I'm following Hoffmeyer's reconstruction, I assume that that's reliable. The route that they are taking is one that was taken regularly by expeditions that are leaving from Egypt and going to the mountainous areas of the southern Sinai to do mining. The things that they dig out of the rocks there are typically copper and turquoise. Those are the two things that they're going to get. But they make those trips in the winter months, and they usually get out of there before the late spring, and it is late spring now when the Israelites are traveling. So it's unlikely that they are going to meet any large groups of people, but this is not an untraveled path that they're on. In fact, since they were slaves, it's possible that some of them actually were taken on some of these mining expeditions, some of the Israelites. They arrive at Marah. Marah in Hebrew means bitter. And again, we don't know where this is for sure. Hoffmeyer's best guess is that this is Bir el-Mura, which is Arabic for bitter spring. And so he's speculating that that name was retained. However, there are quite a few places in that area where the water is bitter. The water at Bir el Mura is bitter because it has dissolved in it magnesium sulfate. In any case, the Mara that they arrived at was a place where there was water, but it was not suitable for drinking. So the people complain. They say, what are we going to drink? We're out here in the middle of the desert. We've used all of our supplies that we brought with us. What are we going to drink? And Moses then takes the appeal to God, and it says that he cried out to the Lord. We've seen that before. There were other instances where the crying out was a crying out that was accusatory. It was implying that Moses had done wrong by bringing them. But this time, Moses is crying out to God and asking for his help in a situation that's serious. I mentioned last week that we're only 3 days now after the parting of the Red Sea. And it's interesting to me, as I pointed out last week, that God would do that. Part the Dead Sea, and then 3 days later put them in a situation where they have no water. It is also interesting that the people who have experienced the parting of the Red Sea 3 days later feel they think that they are stuck in an impossible situation, that God has led them to a place where they can't survive. And it's just, they're no different from we are. We have very short memories. God can do wondrous things in our lives, and we forget very quickly. And that's why it's so important to remember those things. That's why God insisted on the annual celebration of the Passover, to remember what had happened. But God does provide water. It says that God showed Moses a tree. The word for show here is related to the Hebrew word for Torah. And we'll see that in the next few verses, there are about three times when that word shows up. So the Lord instructed him a tree. So the Lord has pointed out this tree to him, and Moses takes that and he throws it in the water, as he's instructed to do. Now, there is a phenomenon. Certain kinds of wood absorb impurities in the water. In reading about this, I discovered that in Sri Lanka, they regularly line the walls of their wells with a certain kind of wood because that wood is known to take out impurities. In this case, we don't know what kind of wood was thrown into the water, but there is a tree that grows in that part of the Sinai, which apparently has the potential of pulling out of the water some of the impurities. It's an acacia seyel, and Robbie, I think, included in your notes a picture of it so you can actually see the tree. So it's possible that that's what happened, is that Moses throws this tree in the water and the wood removes the impurities and makes it drinkable. In any case, that is what happened. God gave them a command to throw the wood into the water. Moses did as he was told, and the water became drinkable. The water became sweet. This lesson, this experience contained a lesson. And I think the lesson that God is trying to communicate through this is those who obey the commandments of God will escape, as he goes on to talk about, escape the plagues which befell Egypt. He says, if you will give earnest heed to the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in his sight and give ear to his commandments and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you which I have put on the Egyptians. So this is just an object lesson. He's having them act this out, and it's intended to demonstrate the significance and the importance of obedience to God. It goes on to say, for I, the Lord, am your healer. As we'll see later and in other instances in the narrative, they're skeptical of God. They are suspicious of him. But God asserts, I am your healer. Instead of your destroyer, I am your healer. I am here to improve things rather than destroy. Verse 27, then they came to Elim, where there were 20 springs of water and 70 date palms, and they camped there beside the waters. Again, it's not known for sure where Elim is. It is thought that that location is Wadi Garandel. It's right on the coast of the Gulf of Suez. So they made it to this next place, and that place is one that still has a lot of water and is a regular stopping place for the Bedouin that travel through that area. If you look on your map, I'll describe where these two places are. They aren't actually marked on your map. I can't figure out how to do that. And the map is probably not in enough detail that you can see very well. But Mara is thought to be at the northern part of the Gulf of Suez. There's a little bump of the Gulf of Suez that bumps out into the east, and Mara would be right at the northern end of that bump. Then Elim, the Wadi Garendel, as you go down south, it's probably one day's march south. I think you can see a place where there are two red roads and they come together. I think that's where it's located. I think it's right between the U and the L in Gulf of Suez. Okay. So they're going right down the eastern side of the Gulf of Suez. Okay. It's interesting that right after this trial at Mara, where they run out of water, just one day's hike away, there's an abundance of water. Not unlike God, having put somebody through a trial for him to provide an abundance. And there are other instances of that in the Bible, indicating that he hasn't lost control of things. He knows what he's doing. There was a purpose for that trial, and then they're provided for abundantly. After they're done at Elim, then, they are going to hug to the eastern shore of the Gulf of Suez. They're just going to go right down. So you've got a red line there that's now a road. You can follow that down along the Gulf of Suez. And Hoffmeyer speculates that in some places they probably could have fished in the Gulf of Suez and caught some things to eat. And there are several places along the Gulf where you can dig and get fresh water easily. You have to go back from the shoreline, he says about 50 yards or so, but in certain places then you can dig there and make a relatively shallow well and get fresh water. So there might have been several places there where they could refurnish their water supplies. Now, as they go south, they're going to come to a mountain, Gebel Hamam Pharaon, and you'll see on your map the red road goes away from the Gulf of Suez for a while, and that's where that mountain is. They, for the same reason as the highway did not go right along the shoreline, they probably did not go along the shoreline. There's just a narrow strip between the mountain and the Gulf of Suez, and apparently it is dotted with places where the water is coming out of the ground and smells heavily of sulfur. It's a very unpleasant place to go through. So they probably went inland for a while till they got around that mountain. Then they're heading down the shoreline again. And they'll go down that shoreline until they have to cut in order to go to Mount Sinai. In Numbers 33:10, it describes their camping place at this point in their journey as Yam Suf, which is the Reed Sea. So in this instance, then, if Hoffmeyer is right, the term Yam Suf is referring to the Gulf of Suez, whereas when they crossed the Reed Sea, that would have been referring to a different body of water. So that same term is being used to refer to a couple of different bodies of water, if Hoffmeyer is correct. All right, they are now down at about the point where they turn inland. And that's not well marked on the map that I showed you, but you'll notice that in the southern Sinai, that is mountainous. And Mount Sinai is kind of in the middle of that. And they are going to cut inland north of Mount Sinai on a wadi that starts right there and cut inland. And you can kind of see where that valley leads into the mountains. Okay. Could you follow their route for those who are interested? Okay. Chapter 16, verse 1. Then they set out from Elim, and all the congregation of the sons of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after their departure from the land of Egypt. And the whole congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the sons of Israel said to them, "Would that we had died by the Lord's hand in the land of Egypt when we sat by the pots of meat, when we ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." Okay, they've been gone a month and a half now, and they have come down the shore of the Gulf of Suez. They are turning inland now. It could be that they have already turned inland and have turned inland for a day or two. I don't know. If they are along the Gulf of Suez and they had been fishing, maybe they've reached a place where they can't catch any fish. I'm not sure exactly what's going on, but they seem to be out of food now. And they're complaining that they wished they had died in Egypt. They're out in this miserable situation. It would have been better if they had just died in Egypt. And back then, back in Egypt, they sat by pots of meat. There was lots of food. They sat by pots of meat, and they ate bread to the full. And we're going to see several references to the bread to the full over the next few verses. So they're saying, man, it was so good back in Egypt. We had lots to eat. We never had to worry about where we were going to get food. And now we're in a place where water's hard to get, and food's even harder to get. This is ridiculous. We should have died back there. We would have been better off. Furthermore, it goes on, "For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly." So not only are they romanticizing how good it was back in Egypt and how much food they had there, and I should point out, there's no indication that they ran short of food in Egypt, but nor is there any indication that they had oodles of food. So I think that that's an exaggeration. It's a romanticization of what life was like in Egypt. But it goes on, it is impugning Moses, saying, "You did this for a malicious reason. You brought us out here to die." So it's romanticizing Egypt, and it's attributing a malicious motive to Moses. Verse 4, "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you. And the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them whether or not they will walk in my instruction. And it will come about on the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily.' So Moses and Aaron said to all the sons of Israel, 'At evening you will know that the Lord has brought you out of the land of Egypt, and in the morning you will see the glory of the Lord. For he hears your grumblings against the Lord, and what are we that you grumble against us?'" So God says to Moses, "I'm going to take care of this. I'm going to rain bread down on you. Food's going to come down out of heaven for you to eat. But this food that's going to come down out of heaven is of such a nature that you will gather what you need on a daily basis. There will be enough for you each day. You go out and gather it each day, but gather only that amount." And he's doing that he may test them to see whether they will walk in my instruction. My instruction here is Torah, in my Torah. Then he kind of mysteriously says, on the sixth day, you'll gather twice as much as you usually gather. He doesn't say why. That's going to come up in just a little bit. He goes on to say in verse 6, "At evening you'll know that the Lord has brought you out of the land of Egypt." And then verse 7, "In the morning." So something's going to happen in the evening, something's going to happen in the morning, and both of those will make clear who this God is that has been taking care of them. And it says, "You will see the glory of the Lord, for he hears your grumblings against the Lord." And then Moses said, "So why are you complaining to us?" And he gets into that more later. Verse 8, "And Moses said, 'This will happen when the Lord gives you meat to eat in the evening and bread to the full in the morning. For the Lord hears your grumblings, which you grumble against him. And what are we? Your grumblings are not against us, but against the Lord.' Then Moses said to Aaron, 'Say to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, come near before the Lord, for he has heard your grumblings.' And it came about, as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the sons of Israel, that they looked toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, I have heard the grumblings of the sons of Israel. Speak to them, saying, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God. So Moses explains to them what's going to happen is you're going to get meat in the evening, and you're going to get bread in the morning that you can eat to the full. And he's going to keep repeating this phrase, you're going to eat this bread to the full. God has heard their grumblings. God has heard their complaining. But nevertheless, instead of striking them down, he's going to provide them with the very thing that they want, the very thing that they're complaining about a lack of. And that grumbling is being directed to Moses and Aaron, but they are not the ones responsible for this. They are merely acting as God's agents. And as a result, their complaining is really complaining against God himself. And to pretend that it is just complaining against Moses and Aaron is a complete misunderstanding of everything that's happened. So this is all announced to the congregation when it's gathered. And when they gather, the cloud that has been accompanying them, it is standing before them towards the wilderness. That cloud that God graciously provided as a reassurance that he was with them, that traveled before them during the day and then was a source of light at night, that was traveling with them all along. Reassurance that God is looking out after them, but something that is easily taken for granted, and that's what they did. Okay, all of this will be provided, as he said, so that they shall know that this is Yahweh, your God, that's doing all of this. Verse 13, so it came about at evening that the quails came up and covered the camp, and in the morning there was a layer of dew around the camp. When the layer of dew evaporated, behold, on the surface of the wilderness, there was a fine flake-like thing, fine as the frost on the ground. When the sons of Israel saw it, they said to one another, what is it? For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, it is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather of it every man as much as he should eat. You shall take an omer apiece according to the number of persons each of you has in his tent. And the sons of Israel did so. And some gathered much and some little. When they measured it with an omer, he who had gathered much had no excess, and he who had gathered little had no lack. Every man gathered as much as he should eat. And Moses said to them, let no man leave any of it until morning. But they did not listen to Moses, and some left part of it until morning, and it bred worms and became foul. And Moses was angry with them. And they gathered it morning by morning, every man as much as he should eat. But when the sun grew hot, it would melt. So there are two things happening. In the evening, they gather quail, and in the morning, they collect manna. First, the quail. There is a phenomenon that happens in the Sinai. It happens even to this day. It has happened throughout the centuries. The quail migrate north and south, and they cross the Mediterranean Sea. And when they are coming south, which would be in the fall months, after they have crossed over the Mediterranean Sea, they are exhausted and hungry, and they just fall to the ground, and they are easy prey until they recover their strength and are able to continue their flight to the south. There are people who have speculated that the route that the Israelites took was along the northern edge of the Sinai, and this would account for the quail being there and being available. And there are two problems with that. One is that phenomenon occurs in the fall. It would appear that this is happening in the spring. The other is that the quail are on the ground in northern Sinai in the fall during the mornings, and this says that it's happening in the evening. So in all likelihood, this is not the migration that's going from north to south, but this is the migration from south to north, and these quail are being exhausted as they fly over the Gulf of Suez. They are landing then on the eastern shore of the Gulf of Suez. They are exhausted, and they are easy prey there. That would be happening in the spring, and that phenomenon apparently does occur, and when that happens, it is in the evenings then that the quail can be gathered up. So that is perhaps accounting for this thing that God is doing. The manna one is harder to account for by a naturalistic explanation. There are a couple of phenomena that could account for this, and I was going to refresh my memory on what those two are. One is a secretion of insects, and the other one is drippings from a plant. The one that's secretion from insects, apparently there is an insect that secretes something that is similar to what's described here in northern Iraq, and the Kurds have historically gathered that when it's available, and it can be gathered in fairly large amounts. But to my knowledge, neither of those phenomena, whether it's drippings from a tree or whether it's secretions from an insect, neither of the things that are produced by that have quite the attributes, as far as I know, that are attributed to manna. So I don't know. I'm skeptical as to whether those naturalistic explanations can account for this phenomenon. Okay. So the quail are landing on the ground in the evenings. The Israelites gather them up, and they can eat those as food. In the mornings, then, there's this layer of dew around the camp, and they are to go out and gather these little crusty wafer things that are on the ground. It is a fine flake-like thing that's as fine as frost on the ground. And the Israelites look at it and they say, "What is it?" And in Hebrew, that is manhu. And out of that eventually comes the term manna. So manna means roughly, "What is it?" So they go out and gather it. And they're supposed to gather an omer per person. I don't know how much an omer is. They're supposed to gather an omer per person for everyone that's in their household. So they go out and gather this up. And after they've gathered this up, when they look at how much, measure the amount that they have gathered, as it turns out, everybody has an omer per person. If I'm understanding this correctly, everybody ends up with an omer per person. Whether they work long, hard hours to gather it or whether they did it quickly, in either case, they end up with the amount we're told to gather. Then they're told to eat all of that day. And, as quite a shock, they did not listen to Moses, and some left part of it until morning. But if they did so, it bred worms. It just turned rotten and couldn't be eaten. Okay. So they gather that in the morning. Whatever is not gathered, as soon as the sun comes up and it gets hot, that melts and is gone away. So it's only available for a short period of time, and it only lasts for a day. Verse 22. Now it came about on the sixth day, they gathered twice as much bread, two omers for each one. When all the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses, then he said to them, "This is what the Lord meant. Tomorrow is a Sabbath observance, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake, and boil what you will boil, and all that is left over, put aside to be kept until morning." So they put it aside until morning, as Moses had ordered. And it did not become foul, nor was there any worm in it. And Moses said, "Eat it today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, the Sabbath, there will be none." And it came about on the seventh day that some of the people went out to gather, but they found none. Then the Lord said to Moses, "How long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my instructions? See, the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore he gives you bread for 2 days on the sixth day. Remain every man in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day." So the people rested on the seventh day. Now it becomes the mysterious thing that was said earlier about they would have this manna for 6 days. Now it becomes clearer why that's the case. They are instructed to gather twice as much on the sixth day of manna so that they have some on the seventh day and they won't have to go out and gather it. And that seventh day then is to be held as a Sabbath, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. And on that day, they will not go out and gather food. They gathered that the day before. And the double amount that they gathered on the sixth day, what was left over after the sixth day to be eaten on the seventh day, did not spoil. Of course, there were some who went out to gather on the seventh day, like they were told not to do, but they found none when they went out to try to gather it. And then the Lord said to Moses, "How long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my instructions?" Okay. All right. Verse 31. And the house of Israel named it manna, and it was like coriander seed, white, and its taste was like wafers with honey. Then Moses said, "This is what the Lord has commanded. Let an omer full of it be kept throughout your generations, that they may see the bread that I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you out of the land of Egypt." And Moses said to Aaron, "Take a jar and put an omer full of manna in it, and place it before the Lord to be kept throughout your generations." As the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron placed it before the testimony to be kept. And the sons of Israel ate the manna 40 years until they came to an inhabited land. They ate the manna until they came to the border of the land of Canaan. Now an omer is a tenth of an ephah. Okay. So this manna, it's like coriander seed. I'm not sure what coriander seed is, but if you know what coriander seed is, that may be helpful. It's like coriander seed. It's white, and it tastes like wafers with honey. So it's a sweet-tasting thing. And Moses was commanded by God to take an omer full of that, a daily ration of that, and to keep that throughout your generations. That's to be put in the tabernacle and in the Ark of the Covenant. Neither of those exist at this point in time, so I'm assuming that this is instruction that was carried out later. I'm not sure when exactly the instruction was given. And they are supposed to keep that then for generations to come. They had this manna throughout the time that they were traveling, walking through the wilderness. So for 40 years, God provided them with this manna. It only ceased when they went into the promised land. A very interesting feature. Okay. What seems to be happening here is God uses the period of time, beginning with the plagues, all through the time that they are in the wilderness, is a time of intensive training of the people of Israel. They had been in Egypt for over 400 years. So their habits, their culture, their thought patterns were all shaped by the culture of Egypt. I said before they were thoroughly Egyptian. That may be a little bit of an overstatement, but they are largely Egyptian in the way that they're looking at the world and in the values that they have. What God wants to do now is he wants to make for himself his own people. He's going to transform them, and he's going to transform them through this process of education that they're going to go through and that they've already begun. I was thinking about this last week. I heard an interview on the radio. They were interviewing a woman in Colorado because they were doing a story on the election this year in Colorado. And they were pointing out that Colorado used to be a thoroughly red state, and now it is becoming more blue, and it is borderline, whether it's red or whether it's blue. And that's largely as a result of the change in demographics. It's because of the large influx into Denver and people moving in from outside of Colorado into the western slopes. And they interviewed this woman who her family has lived in Colorado for a long time. And she said something that really struck me. She said, "We're different from those people." And she listed several ways, but she started out, the first thing she said is, "They take pleasure in things that don't give us pleasure. And we take pleasure in things that don't give them pleasure." I hadn't really thought about it in those terms, but what you take pleasure in is largely a learned thing. It is to a high degree a learned thing. If you talk to people who are wine aficionados, there's a lot of training that goes into learning what is a good wine. That's an acquired taste. You have to learn it. And there are other things that are the same way. I think of movies, fashion, music. To a large extent, what brings you pleasure in each of those is a learned thing. We learn it from our culture. And if pleasure is a learned thing, then values, which are closely related, are a learned thing. So we're talking about a group of people that for 400 years have been developing the habits and the pleasures and the values of the people that they were a part of. And God is taking them out of that, and he wants to provide them with a different understanding of what gives pleasure and what is valuable. So he's taking him through this education process. He begins by showing his power and his trustworthiness. That seems to be the emphasis with the plagues and with the crossing of the Red Sea, is this God is the master of history. He is the force in the universe. And not only is he the force in the universe, but he is able and willing to act on your behalf. He's going to do right by you. So God displays his trustworthiness. And he, with the plagues, he afflicts the Egyptians, but with most of them, with all of the latter ones, he spares the Israelites to show that he makes a distinction and that he is acting on the behalf of the Israelites. Furthermore, he accompanies them with the cloud and with the pillar of fire. He's there to watch over them. And we've seen on a couple of occasions now, God acts miraculously to provide for them, whether it's water, whether it's meat, or whether it's bread. So God is acting overtly in our experience to show them that he takes care of them. But that doesn't mean that they don't experience want. They do. He allows that to happen. So their life in this wilderness, it's not carefree. It's not comfortable. It's desert. It's not fun all the time. And that's not what life is all about. Life is not designed by God to be comfortable and to be carefree. What he's requiring of the Israelites is that they keep things in perspective. That is to say, God has demonstrated his power and his love for them on many occasions, and quite remarkably. But they need to keep that in mind, because at any given moment, they may be experiencing a lack of something. They may be experiencing hardship. And what they have to do is pull back and put things into perspective. God is still there. God is still powerful, and God still loves me. And that's what we call faith. It's the ability to put everything into the bigger picture. Then God begins to describe how he wants the Israelites to live. How should they be living? If they aren't supposed to live like the Egyptians live, how should they be living? And he establishes the national holidays, Passover, Feast of Unleavened Bread, Feast of First Fruits. We've seen him establish those. That's part of what he's doing, giving them a national identity and building into their cultural experiences ways to remember what God has done for them. He's also giving them a set of shared experiences, the plagues. They all went through that. They all saw that. They all saw God's provision for them in the midst of that. The crossing of the Red Sea, they all saw that. They all walked through the water. So a big part of this is the experiences that he provides, and then the instruction that he provides, the Torah. He begins with the Sabbath, and then later there will be other. He will give a number of laws, starting with chapter 20. We'll go through those later. But if God is who he claims to be, obedience is the only reasonable course of action. So Exodus, as I understand it, is a description of the process that God took these Egyptianized people through in order to transform them from Egyptians into Israelites. And as people who understand what God values and have developed habits around what God values. Let's look at manna. I think that's a phenomenal little pedagogical tool that God has chosen to accomplish his purposes. It's interesting to me that very little is said about quail. God provided that, but there's not much said. A lot is said about the manna. That's the really instructive tool here. It has qualities that are designed to build into the people some of the habits and values that God wants built into them. It's on the ground every morning, which means God could have just given them food. He could have put the food out on the table, but he didn't. He puts it out on the ground. Everybody has to go out and work. Everybody has to go out and gather it up. It's not a lot of work, but it's work. It spoils quickly, so you can't stockpile it. You can't build up a reserve. You pick it up every day. You eat what you need that day, and that's it. So it teaches that you can't achieve security by your own efforts. They can only gain security by trusting that God will keep providing this manna on a day-to-day basis. This other feature is bizarre, that when they go out and collect it, it doesn't matter how long they've worked, how much they pick up, when they come back and measure it, they've all got an omer per person. If I'm understanding that correctly, then, it's curious that what he's teaching is the value of trust rather than the value of hard work. If you go out and work hard, it doesn't benefit you any more than the one who doesn't work all that hard. So the value that's being built in here is you have to trust in God, that God will provide, rather than you need to trust in your own efforts and your ability to take care of yourself. Manna doesn't appear on the Sabbath. So even if you go out and try to find it on the Sabbath, you aren't going to get it there. You can't work on the Sabbath. There's nothing to do. And God provided this every day for 40 years. I'm sure they got sick of manna. And I think it's interesting that it says, with respect to the Sabbath, collect twice as much. And you can boil it, or you can fry it, or you can deep fat fry it, or you can whatever you want to do with it, but you'll have some for Sabbath. Well, I'm sure they got very creative of what they did with manna, because I'm sure it got very boring. But that was provision for 40 years that God provided. Just a couple of things that I think are interesting. One is, in Egypt, they had a 10-day week. You work for 8, and you have 2 days off. Now, God is establishing a 7-day week. You work 6, and you get 1 day off. It doesn't take long to calculate. That's less time off. But God is transforming their view of time through habits. He's instilling habits that get them to look at time differently. I think that's very interesting. So manna is a phenomenal pedagogical tool, and it is largely self-enforcing. Moses doesn't have to go around to see if anybody is collecting manna on the Sabbath to punish him, because you can't get it. Moses doesn't have to go around to make sure they didn't save any manna overnight, because it turns bad. Phenomenal, phenomenal educational device. It is forcing them to develop certain habits. I was thinking about this, and it caused me to reflect back on something that I read by Jacques Ellul. He was writing about Revelation, not Exodus, but he said something that struck me. He said, God is ever the creator. He didn't just create the world and he was done creating. God is by nature a creator, and he's always creating. He's always doing the unexpected. He has a character, and he has values, and he doesn't betray those values, and he doesn't change that character. So there's much about him that we can depend on. We can learn who he is, what kind of a God he is, what kinds of things he does. But there will always be ways in which he escapes that. There will always be ways in which he's creating. He's doing something new. He's doing something different. If you'll recall, well, there are a couple of examples that we see in the narrative. I think it's clear that even Moses has limited knowledge as to what God's going to do next. In some respects, he's as much in the dark as the Israelites are. And I think it is extremely interesting that when God sent them out into the wilderness, he sent them south, and then he says, now go north. That change in course, what's going on there? Did God make a mistake? And yet you see from the narrative, that was all purposeful. That was all designed to lure Pharaoh and his armies into a trap, essentially. But that's an unexpected thing for God to say, go south. No, now go north. I think it is true that we will never fully understand the transcendent creator. Figuring him out, I think, is our job in eternity. It's something that we will be working on, and we will not have enough time to do it. Ellul speculates that even in eternity, we will be surprised by God. I think that's very possible. And I can't help but remember the phrase of C.S. Lewis, he is not a tame lion. That is so true. Okay, any questions or comments?
Solzhenitsyn has the day in the life. Kind of two fundamental characters, and there's many wonderful characters, but the Russians make those kind of characters just for fun. But there are two kind of interesting characters that are juxtapositioned against each other. The one being the spiritual transcendentalist, whatever, where he just he floats through his day in the camps, like kind of falling perpetually into this idea that God will provide for him. And Solzhenitsyn does, I mean, the author of that story does provide for that. He doesn't labor, and yet he still survives the day. And then you have the main character who is the constant laborer, the constant socializer, the constant communalizer. He's in the camps with those in the camps, and all his great effort brings about the same outcome as the spiritualist. And the tension of the book, at least in our discussion so many years ago, was who's more righteous? Because the outcome's the same for both. The one who seemingly transcends other people's suffering. They're all trying to keep each other alive and engaging in politics and trade and economy and basically being societies, being a human in the way that we conceive of our arrangement with other people. And the religious one is kind of outside that. He kind of just kind of floats around and somehow he gets his needs met. And you can't even really despise him because he seems to be immune to all the afflictions of all the other campgoers. And then you have the main character who's dutiful. He sees where assumptions are placed on him. He sees who he can make allegiances with to get a little farther. And at the end of the day, they're both in the exact same spot. And it reminds me of your analogy, your description of the man. Of like, you can collect a lot, you can collect a not.
Mm-hmm.
As we've talked about, me and you've talked about in this, we're using this word faith, and it seems like such a hugely complicated word. Mm-hmm. Like, the Jews are going into the desert, and you get a sense that the curriculum of faith has begun. It begins with Moses, and it's a very one-on-one, tete-a-tete, kind of between Moses and God, and the story begins with just this kind of seed of Moses has doubts, and God tells the story of the plagues, and they're really, I mean, I feel like Moses is the star of that chapter. You know, Moses is the major player. We see God with Moses, God with Moses, God with Moses all the way through, and the Israelites don't really form into a person until we get past the Red Sea, and where right. They become a voice, they can complain about something. Before that, they're mostly just a secondary player. Right. And their initiation into, like, kind of the primary, at least maybe an antagonist, perhaps, but at least they have definitely a voice. They have a personhood once they get into the desert. And that's in some ways because some of the burden of faith and the requirements of faith are actually falling upon them. Prior, it seems that it mostly just falls upon Moses and Aaron. They're the leaders of this, quote-unquote, rebellion. I like what you say about God reshaping the psychological identity of a people. And I like the empathy you spread and remind us of, in the sense that God asks that we perpetually learn a new form of cause and effect every single day. When a new small obstacle comes in our way, we don't see the actual salvation. It's not directly straightforward. We only see the diminishing of our supplies. We only see the bills that are coming due. We only see the dynamics with our children that are being created. We don't foresee how those things will resolve themselves, because it's never usually one thing. It's always this, and especially when you look at through the desert, it's always this new magical thing he comes up with. I mean, it's never something as straightforward, and there's this really terrifying unfairness that you would go into the desert where there's nothing, and you'd have to rely on a god that you just basically met, and you would be denouncing your Egyptianness in the course of becoming this thing that you can't really even imagine. You're not given a map for what you will become, the Jew you will be when you walk in the promised land.
Right.
And I think a lot about how when those events occur to us, typically they come in immense trauma. We experience a break in our identity, and I've had several. I think we all do. We go through different phases, different things happen to us, and they reshape our vision of us into something we could have never conceived of, this new thing. And so, coming back to faith, it strikes me that one of the most satisfying definitions of faith is not obedience. I usually despise obedience as a definition of faith. It seems to be an outcome of faith, but it's not faith. It strikes me that faith that is occurring to the Israelites in the desert is a willingness to endure the tension of being submissive, of submitting. Like, so many of the dynamics that God's asking them in the desert, that he's asking them to submit. They have to obey new rules. They have a new week. They have a new identity. They're following a new god. Everything in their existence has been overturned. And even once they get used to it somewhere in the desert, a new thing arises and asks them again to be submissive, asks them to submit to the fact that they're not in control. And it seems like one of the more satisfying definitions of faith isn't obedience, because, again, it seems really like it's like they didn't ask for this. But it's their ability to be in the tension of being submissive, to continually submit. And it's not the act itself of submitting. It's really just the tension that always occurs to us, because I think we're disinclined to submit. We're disinclined to want new laws. We want to get a good strategy going, and we want to rock that strategy all the way till the very end So we don't have the things that are so traumatic occur to us. We don't like things all of a sudden surprising us. We don't like all of a sudden being poor or great changes in station. And so it just seems like one of the more satisfying dynamics or truths about faith is just this willingness to be uncomfortable in our act of submission. Because I don't think we ever get used to submitting. Mm-hmm. But it's that twisting knife, this endless twisting knife of my faith that asks me, okay, because you've lived long enough to know God's going to provide for you, David. You have, I assume.
I have.
And yet...
Whether I believe it or not is another issue, but I've lived long enough.
But you clearly objectively believe it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you read the Bible, right. We're students of the Bible. So it's right. Not a lack of objective understanding. And even so much that you've seen the course of your life, the remembering that God asks of in the Bible, that in some ways is a subjective acknowledgement. You can subjectively acknowledge, yeah, I started here. He has clearly taken me on amazing journeys. So where's the tension? It strikes me that it's like, it's just psychological, and it's somehow based around the identity of submission. Like, that you can objectively understand faith, you can remember your narrative, and yet sometimes we wake up every day and faith is still new and impossible at the same time. And that's the weirdness of faith. Like, yeah. It's not like I'm going to get it right one day and then it will come easy every day. I will get it right and then the next day it will be just as hard. That's why its definition seems so elusive. It feels like a tension and a paradox more than it feels like something concrete. Because if it was concrete, I probably would be able to buy it at the store already.
Right. I agree completely. It's complex and it's hard to pin it down. I have trouble seeing the distinction between being submissive as opposed to being obedient, because in my mind, those would be the same. But I think, especially given the plague narrative, the thing that it's in contrast to is arrogance. What's right at the heart of faith, I think, is genuine humility before God, that I am but a creature, and He is the Creator, and He is a loving God who will do right by me. I think that's right at the heart of faith. Now, what does that dictate that we would do on a day-to-day basis? That's the challenge of life. That is, I think we will wrestle with that throughout until we die. And trying to figure out, what is it that God would have me do in this situation? I've been thinking about this a lot with respect to this narrative, because God acts miraculously on a number of occasions here. And that is not my experience. He does some pretty remarkable things from time to time, but not on the scale that we're looking at here. So how do we decide what steps to take as we progress through our life? And there we come back to One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. Which of those strategies do we adopt? Do we connive? Are we quiescent? Do we do nothing? Do we do something in the middle? And I think the answer is, it depends on the situation, that I think wisdom dictates a certain proportion of each of those, depending on what the situation is.
But there's the tension.
Absolutely.
Tension is not obedience. Tension is some sort of psychological phenomenon that occurs in me. It's not like a positive test. Aquinas can't even see it. It strikes me that, yes, some days we will do the active choice, and some days we will do the passive choice. But the remarkable thing, I think, is to think that Joshua's saying, yeah, let's go do this. When they finally get into the chapter where they send the spies into the promised land, and Joshua comes back with the right answer of, like, we got this. Like, I keep thinking, like, that was the culmination of the journey, that he's this new generation that understands God, has the identity that the whole curriculum of the desert is teaching. Mm-hmm. And I don't necessarily disagree with that, but that doesn't negate the faith of all the people who didn't want to go into the desert. It just strikes me that the tension that we're experiencing seems to be the seed of faith, seems to be, like, our awareness of the negotiation that we're trying to have, that ultimately we have no bargaining chips for, is the bizarreness of our chosen journey, is that I'm not always obedient, and at the same time, sometimes I'm really stunningly obedient, but I wake up with the same deficit every day in regards to faith. I wake up with the same kind of surprise when some obstacle pops up in front of me, and I think, I got nothing for this. I don't have a playbook for what God has thrown at me, and that could just be a normal thing. It could be something as simple as running out of vegetables in our vegetable drawer in the refrigerator.
Right.
And then other days, it's not knowing some ginormous thing of, like, how am I going to get paid for tires on my car? And then my kids have to be in that car, and they have to drive long distances, and I get afraid for their lives. Like, so it's just like, it strikes me that I don't understand how obedience is the prime mover of faith. I think it's, we can talk about what I think that obedience is, but it's just, it feels like that tension, being keenly aware of that tension, that these things that are out of my control are in God's control. And that's not a happy thought. That's a tension in us.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. And that's what I'm describing as humility. And I think I understand exactly what you're talking about. And I think that's probably everybody's experience if they are conscientiously thinking about life. Making those decisions as to what do I do now is oftentimes an agonizing decision. And in many cases, you have three options, none of which are good. And so how do you proceed? And that's the challenge of life. Absolutely. And it is an agonizing one. And I would agree if for 4 days in a row, I were to make good choices with respect to that. That doesn't mean the fifth day, I won't be right back to where I was before, clueless as to what it is that I should really be doing here. It's a strange process that God is putting us through. Okay, thanks.